In today's rapidly evolving tech landscape, the boundary between the possible and the impossible is constantly being redrawn. But what fuels this relentless drive for innovation? It's all about envisioning a brighter future, says Owen Reynolds. Dive into the mind of a visionary as we explore the future of technology, investment, and the untapped potential of Europe's tech scene.
I definitely think that we've not hit the limitations of software on everything, for sure. I mean, look at the AI explosion, but we'll see, you know, how much of it works and how much of it is just fantastic software that was going to be written anyway. But we will need more hardware, plain and simple. We have bigger challenges to overcome than we perhaps ever have, which means that our willingness to make mistakes, make errors, burn capital, frankly, but hit those big successes at the same time. And I want to see more of that brilliance being brought to market, brought to industry, brought to applications, brought to use cases, and really explored. So get out there and do it. Feel free to touch base with me if anybody wants any of my ideas about how to do that.
Owen Reynolds is a key figure at Techless Ventures. He brings a wealth of knowledge from the front lines of venture capital. With a keen eye on the future, Owen and Techless Ventures stand at the forefront of driving innovation in the industrial sector, pushing the boundaries of what's technologically visible. In this episode, you will discover the critical role of hardware in the next generation of tech, why the future of innovation relies on more than just software, the importance of energy innovation, how sustainable energy sources are key to our technological addiction, Europe's untapped potential, the unique opportunities and challenges within Europe's tech landscape, the venture capital perspective, insights into the venture funding landscape and what the future holds, and finally, a call to action for founders, encouragement for European founders to think big and make a global impact. And remember, your engagement helps this podcast bring more valuable insights to you. So subscribe, comment, and share to support the show and help me deliver more insightful content like this episode. Now, let's dive into the full episode and uncover the future of technology and investment with Owen Reynolds.
It's my fourth year of podcasting now, and I started in 2020 inviting past speakers to a Christmas and New Year's recording. And the first one was 3 hours. The second one, I think, was about 6 hours, and the third one was 8 hours. So,
wow. Okay, so you've definitely broken world records. I probably won't have enough content to be a world record breaker, but I appreciate your confidence in me.
I think we find enough content to talk about.
That sounds good. Then we can dive in. Thank you for the detailed questions too. It makes it super easy, and kind of thought through some of the things. But they're mostly you picked up on a lot of the elements that I sent over in the emails, and I think it's a lot of material that I've been thinking about for months and years in a lot of cases.
Yeah, that's great. Nice. I checked also your profiles. There are a lot of articles on the internet. You had a great podcast with European VC about the second. I think you bring a lot of expertise and experience to the table.
That was an odd one. I happened to work down the street from them years ago, and I had an insight into the way that these regulatory agencies work.
So now I'm looking for the, so we started live streaming right now, and let's just move through the questions and go ahead. You are from the US originally. Did I get it right? You're not European by birth.
No, I'm not. I am from Chicago in the US, if you couldn't tell by my giveaway accent, but moved here to Europe about 5 years ago, to join a firm that really had a close thesis to what I was looking for. So have been investing out of Luxembourg, but across Europe as well as the US for several years now. And now I've actually joined the LP and GP side of the table. So I'd always been a GP, but now also an LP as well over the last few months.
Let me ask you the most pressing question that I have on my mind. I mean, usually I recommend investors and European companies to go more towards the United States. What brought you to Europe? What idea did you come from the motherland of capitalism and investing to Europe?
It's an interesting journey, and not entirely, like most VCs' career journeys, not entirely intentional, a lot of luck driven, let's say. But my wife is actually from not too far from Luxembourg. So as we were flying back and forth for family, I got introduced to a team that was close by that happened to be doing an impact-oriented fund in 2018 that was also financially driven. And I'd been in impact investing, like old school impact investing in the US. I was very fortunate to work with, you know, Meteor Fund there. And it was just a combination of finding the right thesis in a team that I wanted to join. And the geography for me was kind of up in the air. Having family nearby helped. So made the decision, and then made the decision to stay kind of continuously over the years, and doubling down on the interesting ability I realized that I have to pick out talent. And I think part of it may be culturally driven, and I'll admit, I think a lot of US managers, a lot of managers, when they're picking out Series A, B, C companies, oftentimes they're looking for startups and companies that can go and raise capital in the American market. So by having come from that environment, it has at least given me like a base ground to compare what kind of teams I think will be able to raise in that same environment that I natively come from.
No, I definitely agree. I mean, your expertise here in Europe is gold. Many people need it to understand how they need to structure their story to be ultimately then able to raise capital from bigger funds. In Europe, we mostly don't have many big funds that can play in the deep tech areas. What's interesting to me is what led you to venture capital? When did you make the decision that becoming a venture capitalist is the right path for you?
So I started off my professional career as a Peace Corps volunteer, which is not the usual place for most venture capitalists. And Peace Corps is a U.S. program that sends young U.S. people, usually shortly after undergrad or after master's degrees, to far-flung locations, usually in developing countries. And I got to work with the ideation stage of companies, and fell in love with the entire process of creating an entrepreneurial journey and starting at that very early stage. So I was encouraging high school and university students to start startups, and then realized I really loved this. And I wrote in a journal at one point, as I was journaling every day, that if I got to do this for the rest of my life, this would be an incredible thing. And I didn't know what this meant at the time, but I went out and started my own startup, co-founded a sustainable construction company with a set of Peruvian investors a few years later, and really started from the ground up. Unfortunately, we had to pivot out of our original idea, but the company continued. And as I kind of did several cycles through other careers, became an economist, 2 master's degrees, I finally came back to what this was, and this was helping entrepreneurs, working at that early stage, helping them get through these different capital formation stages, helping craft their story, work through their business models, fine-tune what they're looking for in terms of candidate selection, and really trying to be there for them on an everyday basis the best I can. And that is what I really love doing on a daily basis. So I found myself back in it. And as I was going into my MBA, I had several ideas of what I wanted to do. And within about 3 weeks, I realized venture and startups was where I wanted to spend my career. So if I retired tomorrow, I'd probably be doing the exact same thing.
That's good to hear. We share a similar passion. When I started in the 90s, business management economics, and the usual path that people got recommended my age was join a big corporation, make a career. And when you are in your 50s, which in my case is just 1 year to go, then you can start a company. How is it in your experience in the United States? What motivates young people to start companies at an early age?
I have 2 answers to that. One is a macroeconomic one. And actually, not a lot of people ask that question, but I think it's an important one. The macroeconomics are such that the dollar-driven global economy, and the fact that a lot of contracts globally are written in dollar terms, has, I think, appreciated the dollar over the natural productivity of the American population, which means that the only things that are really worth your time and effort have to be super productive, have to be more productive than the actual national level of productivity to match the essentially implied productivity of the US dollar globally. And that means that you're driving towards extreme innovation, extreme risk taking on the medical biotech fronts, as well as the tech fronts and business formation fronts. So I think that's one macroeconomic driver that's kind of continued it. However, there's also just this scrappy US mentality of wanting to start things up. And the fact that there is no ingrained or had been no ingrained hierarchy necessarily. And everyone comes from immigrants, like my family from 70 to 120 years ago immigrated to the US. None of them can get jobs, so they all start up companies, and it becomes this wave every time there's new immigrants into the country. Those people start companies, they follow that entrepreneurial journey, and it's become an ingrained part of surviving in America.
That's great to hear. That's great to hear. I think we replicate at the moment this model also here in Europe. You mentioned before that you love helping startup founders, and I would like to dive a little bit deeper in that area. What exactly is it that draws you to startups? Why do you love this area so much?
I think it's the innovation. It's the fact that it's the building. And I love, frankly, if I had gone down that route right away instead of going back to be an economist for a while, I probably would have kept going down that route and somehow got into the investing side. And now I love that a lot too, because I get to work with entrepreneurs, but I love the building part. I like those early stages where it's really about connections and helping individuals build up future huge organizations and thinking through that. Let's take a company that's public right now, what does that company look like? And then working backwards step by step to day one. And what does that company at a future state look like today? And then how do we make ourselves look, feel, act, breathe, and live like this so that we are aiming towards, whether it's an acquisition or an IPO, how do we get towards there by forming ourselves at the prime level from day one?
Yeah, I completely agree to that. It's a beautiful world. Have you ever worked in bigger corporations?
I never survived in bigger corporations. So I did. I spent 3 years working for the US government, which is about as big of an organization as you can get, and quickly got to my cap of creativity. I really appreciated learning how the hierarchy worked, but I also realized that a lot of the innovation and creativity from a lot of the brilliant people that I got to work with was often going into politicking themselves into the gears of the organization, which were well-oiled and did exactly what they were meant to do. But it left a lot to my imagination and how I wanted to kind of spend my energy and really kind of get back out to the early stages of building. So I think large corporations are critical for the world. And frankly, the companies that we invest in are destined at some point to be large corporations, but I've never been one to really thrive in that kind of a setting.
Yeah, but the US government is a huge part. I had a specific reason to ask this question. I think one of the advantages in big corporations, or like the US government, I mean, you have many people who can check tasks off the list. And when I look at the startup stage, basically there is nobody. There is one or two founders, and usually a business angel or a family office or early stage, meanwhile also early stage seed VCs, and that's it. My question to you is, how was it for you moving from a big entity like the US government, where you have many, many, many helpers on teams that can work on tasks, to the startup environment, where basically also people have a lot of ideas what can be done, but need to prioritize and select those tasks very quickly that have the most impact, moving them towards their goal? How was your transition from big companies, big corporations, big entities, down to the very, very small ones?
I mean, I kind of did full circle. So I started on creating co-founding my first startup right after I was in the Peace Corps, and then went to a big organization and realized, wow, there's a lot of focus on these individual elements. And sure, that creates efficiencies and processes, but not necessarily in terms of growth and movement. And I still think that going back to those original stages, incentivizing creativity at a company level is essential to getting that growth, trying a bunch of different things, not necessarily having anyone that's your boss. And I also see that within our companies that have taken off and have raised hundreds of millions over the years, is that they're business units that retain that creativity and incentivize that creativity and give people freedom and just create the incentives for success are the ones that continue to have these breakout successful products or breakout successful business lines. And it gave me, I think working at a big organization gave me faith that people in any size organization have creativity, but we just need to get it aligned towards the end goal. And there's two types of big organizations. There's the ones that do have that alignment towards maybe whether it's top line or margin growth or their place in the market. And then there's ones that give people a limited framework and you stick within that framework. And invariably the ones that give you that growth potential are going to be the companies that define our future.
Yeah, it's interesting. The life cycle of a company that I learned in at university level was company starts, grows, and then disintegrates at some point in time to just stop fulfilling market needs. And then naturally they die and the next wave of companies comes to the market. And then organizations like Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, I think also Tesla is going in that direction, happen that seem to keep their creative touch alive, that don't transition into becoming a rigid big organization, but just keep on thriving and moving forward and keep on growing. In your opinion, as a venture capitalist, what character traits are you looking for in founders that give you the confidence that they will be the ones, the next Bill Gates, the next Steve Jobs, the next Elon Musk? What are you looking for in founders?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
I look for a lot of things, but I'd say the one consistency that I strive for and I push myself for is to invest in people that scare me a little bit. And what I mean is that I want people, I mean, I try to surround myself with people that are smarter than me. It's not that hard, but I really try to find founders that are coming up with something that I'm blown away by. And I want to work with aspirational founders, aspirational co-investors. And it's not just trying to like work with the coolest people. It's trying to work with people that expand my understanding of the way the world works. When someone comes up with an idea that I hadn't thought of or couldn't imagine myself thinking of, that could change an entire industry or the way people live, those sorts of things are really fascinating for me. And those are the types of founders that I want to back. Is there's not a lot of things that Mark Zuckerberg has said, for example, that I naturally am attracted to. One of them was that in an alternate universe, you want to hire people that you can imagine working for. Mm-hmm. And that's what I try to think of when I'm investing. Could I imagine working for this person? Because invariably, when you invest, oftentimes the founder feels like they're working for you. Really, it very quickly becomes the other way around. A good investor should, I think, be pretty hands-on, proactive, asking what the company needs. When they can't do it, tell them straight up, I can't do that. I don't know how to, or I don't know anyone that can do that for you. And then when you do find something that you can push on, you can help on, is dive in. And I want to be able to find someone who I can really rally behind. And not only that, I can honestly pitch to other co-investors that might come on later, to folks that I'm telling that should join the team, because I'm saying these guys are awesome. Follow their direction, follow their lead, and we will all be able to kind of ride this wave.
Go ahead.
You were probably asking like more technically, like what do you kind of check off? Like I've gone towards more technically enabled teams, but really want to find people that both have a great understanding of technical skills as well as are able to pitch their company. Because in the end, as a CEO, you are often the chief cheerleader. And that, you know, at the IPO stage or post, you are the one who's on investor calls defending your organization every quarter. And on the ride up there, you're doing that day in and day out with the media, with your investors, maybe with your board, hopefully not with your board, but those things happen, and you're defending your position in the market and really creating space for the people in your organization to be able to increasingly and more autonomously grow. But you got to understand what your industry does, what your company is doing on a technical level without necessarily always meddling, but knowing exactly when to zoom in and zoom out. And if you don't have the technical depth, I find it is difficult to be able to zoom in to some of the problem areas with the sufficient speed needed.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. You mentioned not only technical skills are important to you, but also pitching skills and selling skills, and also at the end of the day, business skills. I'm currently in the process of reading the book, The Innovators by Walter Isaacson, and it was very interesting to see the story behind Microsoft in this book, especially Bill Gates. I didn't know that he was the one basically who brought the business mindset into companies, and he was the one who hired people and also took sometimes the hard calls and fire people if they didn't deliver, also negotiating tough deals sometimes with external parties while the other ones were tinkering in the background. In your opinion, you work in deep tech. At which point in time does it make sense for a deep tech founder to engage with someone who brings in the business skills into the company or expands their own skill set by doing an MBA? What is the right point in time for a deep tech company? Like Microsoft, right from the beginning, or can they stay longer in the lab and look at the business side later on?
Having done an MBA myself, I'm not sure that that's like the recommended route I would give to a technical founder just to pump up their skills. I think there's probably a lot of other better ways of doing it and more efficiently without ever leaving the workforce. I mean, especially for a technical team, leaving the high tech space is really cutting what you can give back to the market significantly. So I would recommend anyone that's in the tech space to stay in it and not kind of unplug themselves. What I do, like what I got out of an MBA as a kind of an aside, is that I was coming from being an economist to being an investor, and it was two totally different worlds. So I kind of had to pivot into that and learned a lot. So for me, it was worth coming out of the market. Then the other routes I would suggest, though, and I think that's a great question. Should technical founders try to bump up their skills inherently, or should they try to partner with a kind of business-minded co-investor? And I think that comes down to every entrepreneur's individual journey. Like every technical entrepreneur that wants to build a company needs to, I think, decide for themselves, do I have it in me to be the front of the company? And do I want to be the front of the company? Do I thrive in that? Do I thrive in that kind of an environment and that kind of pressure? Or do I want to be the one that gets to create the ideas, the one that is really driving product development and driving our team? Do I want to be working with the nuts and bolts every day? And I think if you can come to a really intellectually honest answer to that, and you know what drives you, then you've got the answer, and you'll already know I should probably go find a co-founder that can help me do this, but also has the enough technical depth to understand what I'm spitting at them. Or yes, I want to embody that, and I want to try maybe angel investing to see what it's like to partner with other great founders. I want to start maybe taking public speaking classes on the side on the weekends to kind of boost my ability to communicate my ideas. I want to start writing because that's a super like low barrier to entry way of doing it, and practicing that way in terms of like getting your management skills, your speaking skills all up to par.
or come on a podcast to practice your speaking skills. So it's also a modern way. I'm asking specifically, I mean, you mentioned in the preparation material I read, opening departure of capital participation into deep tech is one of your missions that you assigned to yourself. And I also started in deep tech in 2006 or in the life science sector, biotech sector. And the usual thing was whenever I drew up a business plan, it was we need 1 billion to bring this thing to the market minimum. And we need at least 100 million to bring this story to a point where we can create something like an exit point for investors, which usually in the European capital market landscape is something that not many people bought into in 2006. Investing became better, but only in tech areas that were more consumer oriented, not so much in the B2B world. And since you mentioned that you seem to have this mission to get more capital into deep tech from the European perspective, what should we do that we attract more capital into this space?
And I'll get to your answer, I promise. I often think about it from a traditional modern portfolio theory perspective. So if you think about the return, the risk return profile, and how that goes through all assets. And of course, the higher you get up on the curve on the risk side, the higher the returns should be. And we usually think of picking a risk tolerance and then the adjacent portfolio or the tangential portfolio to that is the optimal portfolio. And it usually includes a mix of everything from, you know, if you have zero risk tolerance, then of course you stick to just pure debt, it's risk-free. But if you have any risk tolerance, then you're immediately going up the curve into maybe higher yield debt, into equities, into private equities, into real estate, into venture capital, and eventually into crypto, maybe. And I think of it as a mathematical approach that if you pick your risk tolerance sincerely, then construct a portfolio that's mathematically appropriate to that. And what that means is if my team is two people, then I can only go so far on that spectrum. I can only do what two people can professionally do. But if I have 100 people on my team and enough AUM to justify 100 people's salaries, then I should be able to do that entire spectrum in a pretty balanced way. And what I see is that a lot of the approaches to portfolio balances are often based on rule of thumb type of approaches. And in particular in Europe, I feel like that curve is often being truncated at private markets. So we're giving a lot of attention towards debt equity markets. And that alternative asset market is in general often truncated as too high risk for a lot of family offices, a lot of pension funds. And I mean, in my own country, our social security system is based on zero risk tolerance. It is entirely invested into T-bonds, which is literally the world's reference for risk-free capital. So I'm not saying that like any place is perfect. The US isn't even either. But in general, family offices, I do think tend towards balancing this entire spectrum on the risk return profile. Now, at the family office I'm at, I'm very lucky that when I joined, there was already the thesis of investing heavily into private equity and venture capital, but that's not always the case. What that does give is for those that are willing to take the kind of historically mathematical approach to modern portfolio theory, are willing to go out on that curve, are willing to not artificially truncate their portfolio allocation to these fantastic returning assets, and then can do it in a way that is balanced and diversified enough. These are great returning assets. I mean, you and I have staked our careers on it. So I think it's our kind of part of our duties to explain this to our incoming, to other LPs in the market. And part of me is just, as an old economist, I want to see more capital formation on this portion of the market. And I think we're all headed there. And I think it just needs a bit more data and a bit more pushing and a bit more risk tolerance. And I'm already starting to see more family offices talk about capital generation instead of capital preservation. And I think that is becoming the right attitude, because if we're not keeping up with this market on capital generation, you are falling behind.
I could not agree more. I could not agree more. When I look, I mean, I grew up in the 90s and it looked like Europe is at par with the United States in the mobile market back then. When in 2023, I mean, the digital space is driven by the United States on the one side and also by China on the other side. They have fantastic companies here. In Europe, we don't have anything. And I totally agree to what you say, that the market seemed to be truncated. Taking risks doesn't seem to be really a European attitude. And I always think, I mean, when I invest all the capital that I have in one company, in one deep tech company in the early stages, of course, it's a high risk. I mean, the rate of failure is 99%. But when I construct a portfolio of 100 companies, the probability that one succeeds and becomes the next Apple is very high. When I know where to pick and have access to the right deal flow, of course. So when a big family office or foundations, for example, in Austria, foundations seem to have 100 billion euros capital. When they invest only 1% in a deep tech fund, it's 1 billion. And with a fund manager like you, you can diversify the investments and narrow down the risk. Can you dive a little bit deeper into your strategy to de-risk a portfolio to make it more attractive to the risk-averse investors? What buzzwords do you use and how do you explain the story?
I'll start one step before, because I think there's an on-ramp to getting to where we are today. And the on-ramp, I think, starts with doing exactly what I described at the beginning, where if you're thinking about how many people you're allocating to the space and how many people your AUM justifies, then what is the depth into that market that you will require? Now, to be able to do a solid or add a solid exposure into venture, you would need either an extremely well-indexed direct fund or a well-diversified set of GPs. And there's probably the easiest way of starting that is going through fund to funds. You can get immediate exposure into a broad set of funds. There's a handful of great existing fund to funds in the European market now, both at the early stages and the later stages. Early stages tend to be a little bit better performing, but have a little bit more volatility, as you'd expect. But there's ways that you can immediately go into the market as a family office or as an endowment or as a pension fund and put fairly meaningful tickets without necessarily having to risk that learning curve of picking managers. Once you kind of get past that barrier and if you have enough people on your team to actually pick managers, then you can start to create a diversified portfolio. You want to, of course, aim for the best managers possible, but also managers that you trust and believe in for the next cycle. A lot of times, you know, these are 12-year relationships, especially as in we talk about a 10-year relationship as a direct investor in the startups, but the LP usually thinks of it as the 10+1+1 and maybe even longer. So if you are going to start that relationship with a GP, you do want to make sure that their next fund and the fund after that looks like it's going to be just as investable as the previous ones, that they've got a succession plan, that they've got a great bench of up-and-coming partners and principals that will carry this firm on for a long time, and that ecosystem that they're building is important. Then after that, we're kind of in the in-between stage. Now, I would always encourage, I think, pension funds, family offices, to diversify across a lot of GPs and create a sincere strategy and then really make sure that they know their timeline, they know their cohorts, they're measuring a single vintage and then closing that vintage, measuring that going forward, and then opening another vintage. Because if you kind of measure a kind of continuous vintage, you'll always be in the bottom of the J curve. And what you want to be able to see is, did we have success on these 2 or 3 years? And are we out of the J curve? Are we up into above 1x TVPI? Are we into return territory? And then can we do it again? And that leads to, I think, where you're actually asking, which is, what do we do? And what we do is a combination of ballast on our portfolio. So we anchor our portfolio with managers that are aspirational for us to work with, that we love hearing from, that are thought leaders in the space that we truly admire. And then we also direct invest. And what that is allowing us to do is by anchoring our portfolio with incredible managers, we set the bar pretty high on the on the return side. And we kind of ensure that a portion of our portfolio is entrusted into a diverse set of hands. By doing that, we ensure that it's, you know, not just our team, but also other teams that are taking on management. It also helps us professionalize our operations. We see amazing managers. We see the way they're reporting. We see the companies, the types of companies that they're investing into. We can get insights into different markets. And that's on top of the potential if they think we're good enough to bring us in on direct deals. And then on the direct side, as I mentioned, that's the bar. Like within an endowment and a family office, yes, you want to commit to a time period. But if your direct deals aren't beating the managers you're investing in, there's probably no reason to do it from a financial perspective. And then you just need to decide, is this something that our organization needs from an operational side or from a strategic side? And otherwise, from a pure financial perspective, you do have to have a decent team to be able to allocate to that breadth. So I hope that starts to get to the point.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I was smiling because when I reached out to you, I listened to your episode on European VC and liked your messages, liked your voice. I think you have great things to say and participate.
Thank you.
And I said, addition to the European ecosystem. And after I reached out, you agreed to the podcast that we do the recording. I started my research on Techless Ventures. And first I read Fund of, say, well, great, I know my first Fund of on the podcast. This is quite interesting. And then I also read that you invest directly in startups. And I said, no, wait. They said Fund of, and then invest in startups also. And I didn't get around this in my mind. It seems to me like a contradiction. What was the reason to decide at Techless Ventures to, on one hand, invest in venture funds, and on the other hand, also go for startups?
So I have the great fortune of having been brought on after a lot of that decision making was formed, and I'll give a lot of credit to the principals, the family behind the fund, for having kind of worked through a lot of the math basically behind it, and saying we want to go into private markets. We have an edge, and as some background, Techless is an automotive supplier based out of Turkey, but with 12 manufacturing facilities in 6 different countries and 250,000 square meters of manufacturing space. And they have serious kind of competitive advantages in automotive, as well as robotics and automation, and several ancillary areas within the Industry 4.0 segment. So they went first into the private equity markets to leverage that expertise. And now we're adding on to that into the venture segment. So I joined earlier this year, so it's been, we're still building, but a lot of the thought process on how to take on that kind of risk, segment it, was already kind of thought through. But the way that we're kind of explaining it to the market is we're using, like from a financial perspective, we're using these investments into great managers as this way to anchor our returns, be able to take on the appropriate risk that a true venture fund will have on the direct side, and then make direct investments the same way a venture capital fund would. So I'm coming from being a GP, so that's kind of my mindset is to work with founders the exact same way. Whether we can take a board observer seat, we're still there for every part of the journey, and that is and that's exactly the way we want to be able to optimize across those two sides. And actually, frankly, I should say too, by having a strategic company like Techless, and I'm kind of pitching this, but I think this is true for a lot of different corporates, is find the like 2 or 3 or 5 things you do really well, and tell your GPs and your companies, these are the things we're good at. These are the things you can call us for. And for both your GPs and your companies, you want to be a real resource for those things. And then for the other things, you just trust that by the point you invest, you should be able to trust them to kind of run on their own without bothering them, without wasting their time, without asking too many questions, and just be there as a resource when they need you.
I'm curious now, how would you pitch in 1 minute Techless Ventures?
So we've got the backing of a great corporate with a history in automotive and automation, and we are building out a portfolio of Industry 4.0 using those same levers of expertise, both for a set of GPs and direct investments into some of those same segments. So we want to be actively involved, and we know the things that we're good at. Here are the set of things we've got expertise in. And with everything else, we're of course there as sounding boards and general startup investors. We've been through the process before, but we've got here are the things that we're good at. And I encourage a lot of GPs to do the same thing, to tell their founders what they're good at, what they're not, so you know who to come to, and you are part of the founder's portfolio too, and a GP's portfolio of capital. And you want to come with more than just the capital, but also bringing some expertise.
I have some fund managers in my business environment that I know are currently in the process of fundraising. What's the ideal manager for you? What are you looking for in funds when you invest as a fund of fund?
So from our perspective, we've started at, let's say, the ground level. We have been aiming over the last couple of months for managers that have a long track of DPI, so distributed to paid in capital, which means distributions made to LPs that we can measure. Not a lot of funds have that. So we've limited ourselves to a pretty select group of managers. And I think that's been a good way for us to take advantage of the market sentiment right now, and frankly, get access to great funds. I think that access, though, is available to a lot of funds. As I mentioned at the very beginning, there's just a lack of capital for amazing GPs. And in the US, to get into amazing GPs, you'd have to knock down their doors or put 20 million in, and there's no in between. In Europe, you can, if you're kind of good at this and good at picking and good at, you know, adding value in the one or two ways that anyone can, I think there's an incredible amount of opportunities for family offices, for especially nimble family offices, but also for pension funds to dive into this market. So that didn't really answer the question, but what we're actually looking for is now being able to extrapolate. So what does an emerging manager, for example, look like now that we've got, you know, a couple of funds that we've invested in that are or they're invested or passed RIC. What are the things that we're looking for? What are the things that these funds, and similar to what an IPO ready company looks like on day one, what is an emerging manager that has done six funds of DPI look like at day one? And not knowing currently what their track record is, but looking what their network is, their ability to pick, their track record, the strength that they have in terms of making introductions, all of those qualitative analytical things that are tough to measure, but essential to being able to pick out the next generation. Now, I hope we're able to do it, and I think so, but it's a lot of pattern recognition, just like venture investing itself.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. With Decas, I mean, you have this very special mission to invest in startups and funds. And usually when I look at the deep tech sectors, I have three buzzwords. So it's like a trinity. You have game-changing technology, you have social impact, and then returns. When you look at these three different areas, how do you measure your success in these areas at Decas Ventures? How important are they to you?
I think any venture activity needs to be measured first on returns. And this is after coming from a long background of impact. I don't think we can get the world's capital environments motivated and invested, the pension funds, the endowments. We can't get these big capital flows if we're not doing above market returns. And I think that is the number one lesson for both GPs and for founders, is that it still needs to fit the venture model. Same with infrastructure and private equity. It has to fit the model. And the reason is those capital flows are coming from folks that have fiduciary responsibilities to their shareholders. And they need to return that capital for people to survive in their 70s and 80s and 90s, or for university students to go to university, or for families to provide for the next generation. These are essential. So these are essential financial markers, and it's part of our, you know, the intermediary's financial duty to be able to return that capital. And in addition, there's the perspective in the market that these are riskier assets. Whether that's true or not, we have to adjust for that, which means we have to be above market return rate. So then getting to the rest of it, how do you measure the other things? I think there's been a lot of froth in the market on the whole ESG and impact criteria. I've got a lot of probably unpopular opinions about it. My general thesis is if you can sleep at night, honestly and sincerely, and you know that you're pushing in the right direction, and looking at scope one, scope two, and scope three from now through the next 20 years of your company's operations, where that company is going to be sourcing, where that company is going to be operating, how that company is going to be treating its people, then measuring it, I feel like, is kind of a fool's errand. That said, we've all got to measure it. And and if you want to be compliant, you've got to follow the rules. So I think it's a mix of marketing and intention. But as with so many things in this super opaque market, it comes down to, do you trust people? Do you trust the individual founders to be running their company in the way that you also feel is appropriate for your funds risk tolerance, or your principal's risk tolerance? And do you feel the same way about the managers? Are they going to be investing? Yeah, every manager has to shift and invest into new areas when they become available and create new theses. But do you expect them to be able to have a way of driving their investment theses into areas that are not just only capital returning, but also ethically aligned with your, again, your fund and your principles behind you?
That's great. Making profits and conserving a good night's sleep as success criteria. That's genius. Let's tell a little bit at profits. I mean, it's something that I'm always surprised when I talk to investors and entrepreneurs here in Europe, that it seems to come last. And when startups come to me and say, can you help us raise funds? They always say, I don't see anything in your presentation where you show the potential investors that your technology will not only be game changing and make a great social impact, but also fulfill their return criteria. And can you expand a little bit more on that area? Why, first and foremost, also venture funds and funds of funds must be capital allocators at their core? Or am I wrong?
No, you hit the nail on the head. And that goes back to, I actually had the good fortune of one of the partners, one of the managing partners of the first fund I was at in Luxembourg. If he didn't understand this one key point, would always ask, how do you make money? And it got me at the very early days to ask that same question. Okay, how does this company make money? And in the end, a company isn't self-sustaining if it's not making money, of course, right? And that being the priority is something that I think was lost during the bull market. I think it's coming back to the fore right now, fortunately. And I see a lot of new founders coming, kind of highlighting that in their pitch decks and saying, this is how we could get to profitability. You know, maybe we don't need to, depending on capital markets, but here's one thesis. Here's how we at least boost top line. Here's how we could theoretically eventually get to margin production, margin generation. And I think having that kind of thought process is really important. And the reason that I think you're entirely right to say that first and foremost, investors are exactly that. They're investors and capital allocators. And to be able to do that efficiently and get the big capital flows that we need to make the impact that we need and the changes we need that when you're trying to give capital away, or trying to give it at a reduced rate, you're actually slowing down the maturity of the risk and the return profile of an entire industry. So by expecting market returns and demanding market returns, what you're getting is a mature set of founders, a mature set of managers. And I think we're starting to see that. There's been a whole new set of GPs that came into the market over the last few years that are heavily focused on impact, but also recognize that they are under a lot of pressure to generate returns. And in this market climate, they will be under even more pressure to generate those big venture type returns. And same for every other private asset class. So just like you said at the onset, this is about matching real impact to a financial model. And that's what we're bridging right now.
Yeah, I totally agree to what you say. I mean, if funds don't focus on creating returns, they will lose credibility with their investors. And when they lose their investors, they are not beneficial to their founders either, because they don't have capital in future. So they will have a hard time raise funds 2, 3, 4, and 5. And my advice to startup founders is always, first and foremost, when you want to sell to an investor, tackle the return expectation and have at least a story or create its default process, as you said, how you plan to create returns to get the investor what they need to prove to their investors that it makes sense to go deeper into that. And the second part that I'm curious to learn or to hear from you is investing. I mean, it's always very comfortable to invest in bubble territory. So for example, 2 years ago, I mean, we had this beautiful crypto bubble, Web3 bubble, and it feels so comfortable when everybody explains that the next generation of technology is coming to fruition and you see everyone investing and running into that area. And when I listen to Warren Buffett, he says it would be the most stupid thing to invest at this point in time. You should wait until the market collapses and then pick up the good opportunities. But the downside of investing in a down market is nobody wants to go there. Everyone is scared. And when you look now on media, I mean, I think we probably are at the bottom of the down market because everyone is fearful, everyone is scared. And my question to you is, how do you convince LPs to put money down in this market environment?
Again, unfortunately, in our fund, the thesis was already there when I came on board, so I didn't have to tackle that myself. It's kind of cheating. But yeah, I agree. Of course, investing in the down markets, especially when a lot of tech companies have laid off tons of workers and there's just talent everywhere, it seems like hypothetically a fantastic time to invest. But you're right. Getting over that fear sentiment is a tough barrier for fund managers. And right now, there's still that sentiment that you want to hold on to a little extra cash in case. But then when you think about what would you use that cash for, okay, if you're a pension fund, you have to meet obligations. So make sure you have enough cash budget to meet obligations with maybe a little extra runway than usual. If you usually have cash for 18 months out, then make it 24. But usually, if you're thinking about long-term investors and you don't have outlays required on such a rigid deadline, then your cash allocation is really there to pick up opportunities like this. So then you should be kind of slowly, not all in one go, but slowly redeploying into the market if you have built up cash reserves. So I think it goes back to that thing that I said at the beginning, that is take an academic and mathematic approach to the to allocation. And when you remove sentiment from the equation and remove fear from the equation and start thinking about when and where should we deploy based on financial signals, based on historic movements, this is a fantastic time to invest. So I'd encourage a lot of managers to really divorce themselves from fear and dive in.
That's great. That's great advice. You're an American in Europe, and it's for me a great opportunity to ask you about your perceived similarities and differences in the European venture capital market. I mean, I have my opinion on the European and the US one. I would love to hear how you see it.
Some of the things go back to that earlier part where there's a slightly different cultural risk tolerance. And I think that's one of the more defining ones, whether it's because of those macroeconomic trends or just the kind of immigrant history of the US and the lack of hierarchical order. That said, there is more hierarchical order every year, so maybe that won't last forever. But I think that that adds to the kind of end product, which you see, which is this tendency towards company creation. But I think that is changing too. And I mean, I've definitely bet my career on it. That's, as I mentioned at the beginning, that's why I stayed in Europe and didn't go back, is because I started seeing this incredible talent that wasn't getting invested and was getting looked over and wasn't able to get to big invested capital, which means there's an opportunity to help great founders to kind of reach formation. And even founders that are well experienced and have exited from two companies, maybe they can raise their seed in Series A from previous investors and families that they've gotten to know along the way. But does that mean that they can go out and raise a Series B from the, you know, four or five European funds, or do they have to go into the global capital markets? And I think that's what's still available to for a lot of investors to help on and to a certain degree kind of take advantage of. So whether you're looking at it as kind of arbitrage or supporting, there's a gap and it probably will be filled over time. But I think the big other thing that I see as being an American in Europe is the tendency towards limiting companies to a geography. And I think that when you start to think of individual countries as geographies and linguistic barriers as geographies, you're limiting your company's growth. And I would encourage a lot of companies to forget about language barriers to the extent you can and try to follow the industrial routes. So that's easier to say from an industrial perspective than a consumer investor's perspective, where like language is basically everything and culture is basically everything. But if you're thinking about the auto industry, yeah, it's going to be predominantly German, going to be predominantly DACH. But that doesn't mean that there aren't going to be critical Italian, Spanish, and French players and Czech and a whole lot of other companies. And then you have all the suppliers in Turkey, for example, which I've gotten attuned to over the last couple of months and across Eastern Europe. When you can fine-tune your message as a startup to an industry, you pick up their critical dialogue and find a way to make yourself fit that, you can find viral routes that cross international borders that ignore, that only bump up into those things when it comes to, yeah, the pain of doing VAT and stuff like that. But for the most part, I think there's a lot of viral routes that are not taking advantage of that in the US are obvious because there's no linguistic barriers, but we can create in Europe across industries or within industries, across verticals and through these different kind of viral routes that I'd love to see explored.
Yeah, it would be great to see the European Union being perceived as one market. I mean, when I think about Europe, e-mobility, for example, it's genius. We have still sometimes the mindset of the 80s and 70s, where Germany is Germany, France is France, Spain is Spain, Italy is Italy. Then we decide on e-mobility, where basically in certain areas, 95% of the value chain is controlled by China. And so we don't have it in Europe. And then we still think in these small territorial bubbles. The second thing that I find very compelling in what you said is that we have a lot of talent here in Europe, but not enough capital. And I think this is a real problem here in Europe, especially we have Horizon Europe. We train our
I think the non-dilutive capital is super important in terms of getting companies funded, but I do agree that sometimes it can send the wrong signals that you should be focused on writing a grant, which takes a really long time to write like 50 pages or 100 page business plan that no investor is ever going to look at. So I really going back to the initial part that we talked about, bringing in more capital is really the way to into the ecosystem is really the way to do it. And it's not that the capital is not there. It's just that the risk tolerance isn't there. And it goes back to this sentiment that certain assets are too risky or don't have the data behind them to justify future investment. Fortunately, the same institution that is investing from the state, so the EIF, for example, is creating incredible data that I think is starting to show to family funds, to pensions, that this is a sincerely investable asset class. Now, I guess it would have taken a little bit of leap of faith 10 years ago for a pension fund to say, okay, this kind of looks like the way the US market looks and there's data in the US, so we can kind of port that over. Now, I don't think it takes that leap of faith. You can say, this is the data for the DACH region, for France, for Spain, for the UK, for the last 25 years. And the data is just as promising that funds, that the average VC return, the median VC returning is above the average of any benchmark of public equity funds. So we should probably be over allocating into that same profile. And if you have this risk adjusted, diversified portfolio, you'll be able to hit those returns if you're doing it in a smart way. You have to hire professionals. You can't just do it, just dabble. This has to be like a commitment. And when new funds go into the market, they need to commit to it. They should know that there's a J curve, that you're going to lose at the beginning on paper, and then you're going to gain on paper, and that the end returns in cash are going to be somewhere between the paper high and the paper medium. And being able to stomach that and take it from a really academic perspective is, I think, still tough for a lot of funds. I mean, just like we always said, you never got fired for investing in IBM. That was, you know, the old saying when IBM was still at the top of their game. But I think the same is true for any blue chip type of investment. When you want to make a safe investment as an investing manager, you go towards the stable, perceived higher quality. And when you think about capital flows being stuck in some of those assets, maybe some of those assets are even overvalued because, as I mentioned, like the risk return profile being truncated means that inherently more assets are being funneled into lower risk assets in Europe. So we're probably undervaluing the risk part of the spectrum, which even creates, like, means that the opportunity is even bigger. So just going back to like the basics of taking that mathematical approach, a real philosophical stance on what we're going to do, commit, and then measure.
Yeah, great words. I mean, you mentioned investing in the public sector. So now investing in Apple seems like to be a no-brainer. But going back to 1997, when basically Apple was close to bankruptcy and they brought Steve Jobs back, or seizing the opportunity, Amazon in 2001, who invested in Amazon in 2001, when they lost 90% of their market capitalization. But this would be the right point in time to allocate capital. And we just miss it in Europe. This is really so risk averse, and we miss great opportunities because we don't put capital down. I hope we can change that.
I think it is changing. So. Yeah, and I've seen more and more managers. They tend to be young, but not always. Sometimes I'd say there's like a middle ground of managers that are still worried about their careers. Then there's the more seasoned managers that are seriously wise. Those people, when they tell you that this is that venture and private equity is the way to invest, they shift markets. And then you have a ton of upstarts on the other side that are in their 20s and 30s and also seeing the opportunity maybe from fresh eyes. And not that it's entirely an age thing, but they tend to be the ones with the least decision-making power, unfortunately. They're the emeritus and the juniors. And we need to pressure that towards the senior managers to see that same vision. But I am hearing it on the market. For example, I was at IPEM a couple of weeks ago, and for the first time I've been in the LP conference. I'd always been on the GP side, but I got to join the LP conference for a day, and it was fascinating. The universal story across all LPs was deploy to VC. And then the following day, when it's GP and LPs, I heard from every GP, but no one wants to talk to me. And I'm talking to wonderful aspirational GPs, and they're still saying that the LPs who heard the day before that every other big LP that's on stage is saying double down into VC right now, the next day they're not following that message. So there's still is this disconnect, but I feel like it's getting closer and closer and closer. And the more data there is, the more risk tolerance there is, the more the message gets out there that this sector does work. I think the more likely we are to get that capital into the market required to eventually funnel down to innovation and pull people out of the lab based on capital incentives instead of grant incentives.
What's your opinion, this disconnect between GPs and LPs? What's the reason in Europe that there is this perceived disconnect when you say, on one hand, LPs say double down on VCs, and then the fund managers say, nobody talks to us? Where does it come from? What's the problem?
I think private markets tend to work on weird lags, first off. Like, there's no data until the end of the quarter, which, you know, happens. You get your data from the end of last quarter, 2 months later. So that's part of it. And the other is that a lot of it is investment committee allocation. So when you go to your IC, you're like, this is what we're going to do. 6 months ago, the market still looked like it was at a pretty risky spot. So everyone started their 2023 plan thinking, all right, let's pull back into cash. Let's reallocate into finally high yielding debt. But no, the real story is that this is a fantastic time to invest into innovation, invest into managers that can pick innovation. So I think there's this lag as capital markets begin to return. We've seen two IPOs now that I think have been indicative, not telling, but have started to indicate that the market's coming back, or at least stabilizing towards some sort of fluidity. But it is going to take a little bit of time for investment committees to reallocate into venture capital and listen to sometimes their own investors who are saying, I see an opportunity. Here's why X, Y, and Z. And after 3 months of data or 6 months of data are going back to their ICs and saying, this is what we see. This is what we need to do. Then the ICs unlock a new portion of capital allocation and they can double down on new managers.
Yeah, but
it takes a little while. Yeah.
That's true.
I don't think that's a huge long-term problem. I think that it was probably just that seems more like a question of U.S. versus European kind of robustness of business model versus expectations from bankers. But I think in either case, like showing that that it just didn't get destroyed or was able to get to that it's able to get to markets, I think was a good sign. And it also means that the capital formation machinery is kind of getting back to work, which I think is important.
Now, I think it's always a good time to invest. So there's no problem. I think one of the European problems that I see that we have is, I mean, also e-mobility, coming back to that area. I think one thing that we tend to do that is probably different to the United States is we lock in very early. So climate change is the big problem here in Europe. It's a big problem in the United States. But when I look at the United States, it seems to me they are more open to diversify their investment and say, okay, let's play around with tech and see who's winning. And in Europe, we locked in very early that we want to have, when it comes to mobility, when it comes to cars, we want to have electric vehicles. That's it. And we want nothing else, which is locking in on one technology very early. And you mentioned before that there is this disconnect between GPs and LPs. And I've just thought maybe this is also the problem, that when the LPs say we double down on VCs, they select a handful of VCs and then everybody invests in one fund and don't diversify across more funds. Do you see such a dynamic or is it just...
There's kind of two different points. Two different parts there. So I'll try to answer the second part first. I think diversifying into a lot of different GPs is a bit of a team power. So a man and woman power type of a question. Do you have the team size and breadth to cover markets? And I think going back to what we talked about earlier is if you have that sincere allocation and you decide we're going to do this and commit to it, then there has to be a team component. You need to know how many FTEs are on this to be able to make it happen. And they have to have some experience in the field. And of course, they have to be sufficiently diversified. That said, I think there's a little, quite a bit of focus on, let's say, flight to quality. And as markets sink, as there are more opportunities and less capital on the markets, it means that capital tends to be allocated to the highest performing assets and the highest performing teams. And I think that's natural. It's also probably healthy for the ecosystem. In terms of what does the European GP ecosystem need, it needs amazing teams that are able to consistently overperform, pick and form the best companies, serve on the boards of the best companies repeatedly. And if we're focusing capital towards those entities, I think that that's probably a healthy thing for the ecosystem. What it also does is it kind of mixes up a bunch of the maybe underperforming teams. There were a lot of great managers in some of those underperforming teams. But what that ends up doing is if those underperforming teams have to kind of slow down or shut down, then probably the managers, the managing directors are sticking on, or maybe the one or two founding partners are sticking on. But it means that the juniors or the mid-level partners that are super hungry for deals and might have been adding great value, some of those players are now loose in the ecosystem and can be picked up by either new great funds that existed or new and up and coming funds. And I think that creative destruction is part of a healthy ecosystem and is one of the reasons that the booms after the bust are so robust, is because things are kind of shaken up and they get reoriented in a way that is not as ossified as at the peak, where you're just expanding every balloon out there. Now we're popping the balloons, rebuilding, making stronger balloons, and re-blowing them up probably in the next boom and bust cycle. So the other part you asked about, I think, was lock-in in terms of technologies. And in terms of US and Europe, US tends to go more by market signal and less by directive. That's not always the case. I mean, look at the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act in the US is pretty much points you in one direction. So I think some of that is kind of coming to... Or kind of converging between the two continents. That said, there is still this tendency towards directing a single industry, and there's certainly downsides towards you know, are EVs the answer to the future? My personal sentiment on that is actually increasingly under question. My wife is a filmmaker, and her new project is tackling this exact question: what's happening on the ground? You know, where are these minerals coming from? And it's this all of these hidden corners of the world, often populated by land connected and indigenous people, that are actually the ones that have been safeguarding these places where natural resources are hidden for millennia, and now are at the front lines of deciding the future for our sustainable future. And then how sustainable is that? So having markets decide in the end has like these downsides, where sometimes those areas get exploited, and hopefully markets can react quicker though than and correct for those sorts of things than a policy could.
I couldn't agree more. I think also that the power of the markets is to be very selective, to select what's working, and
I really hope that we don't. And from what I understand, so I wasn't in the European landscape at the time, but I understand that, yeah, after the last kind of financial upset, there was a long dry period where everyone was just kind of trying to survive. And I think going back to that increase in data, I would be pretty surprised if that were the case going forward. As I mentioned, like what I heard from other European and US VCs about, or LPs about investing in a VC at IPEM a couple of weeks ago, I don't expect that to be the case. And I think that there's sufficient data on European VC now that this is an overperforming sector, which means underinvested and arbitrage opportunities exist, that I expect enough smart capital to remain on the market. That said, the time horizons have changed. And instead of doing 2-year funds or 3-year funds, we're talking 4- and 5-year funds. And I think that might slow down the investing cycle for the near term. I think we'll probably get back to that maybe 3-year median. But in the near term, it seems like a lot of investors have indeed slowed down, which also means that the funds that are doing deals, it tends to be like the partners and the managing partners that are making decisions. And a lot of the juniors are not always able to make the decisions because there's just not enough capital to be doing 10 deals a year. Maybe they're doing 5. So I think that changes the market a lot. But in the end, again, after all the pain of reshuffling the deck, there's going to be a lot of great talent out there. So I encourage everyone to just be hopeful. And maybe it's the American in me, but I'm hope springs eternal in me. And I think venture investing and the tech ecosystem is all about envisioning a better, brighter future. And I mean, if we're not seeing that, I don't think you have the right mindset to be in this game. And I think a lot of the best people in the market are super ambitious and have great expectations for the long-term future, are super doubtful about what could happen tomorrow or the day after. And that's just the mindset to kind of adopt during these, during every market cycle, especially during the peaks and for sure during the troughs as well.
You mentioned time horizon a couple of times, and you invest in deep tech. What's the right time horizon when someone wants to go into deep tech?
I think that 10-year time horizon of a traditional VC fund is already pushing on the clock quite a bit. That said, it's also a good impetus to rein in founders that may not otherwise feel pressure to find an exit window, and especially for underperforming companies. This kind of goes back to one of my other kind of differences between Europe and US that I'll always probably push on, is the ability to liquidate companies. And I mean, in the US, sometimes founders that have raised 20 million, they'll return half the capital if they think they need to shut down the company, and that's okay. I mean, frankly, it's better for the VC's returns. If they don't burn through all of it for the next 5 years, and you're sitting on the board trying to figure out how to make this work. If it is clear to the founders that this isn't going to work and you can retain your reputation and go back and raise capital later, by all means do that. But in Europe, it is very difficult to shut down a company. Very, very difficult and painful to fire people. I think for most organizations, that's incredibly important and very beneficial for the general environment. It makes family life better. It makes stability better. But when it comes to the high tech and high risk environment of startups, there needs to be carve outs. And I think being able to like adjust for that across different business models and maybe sizes of companies would help the liquidity of talent that we see in Europe.
Yeah, winding down companies is not so much a tradition here in Europe, it seems, and it's always perceived like going bankrupt, which is traditionally culturally a little bit difficult. I totally agree to that. Coming back to time horizon, there was a notion, I think 2 years ago, I think Sequoia was one of the funds, Andreessen Horowitz also, that said that they are going to longer time horizons, 20 or 30 years. What do you think about this approach to set up funds with a very long time horizon?
Like the Sequoia Heritage Fund, right? Yeah, I think there's, I think what they did was really smart. I mean, they have a dedicated team for it that is separate from the investing team. And what that means is it's basically like a handover. It's not necessarily the same fund because I'm not a public market investor. I use the public markets to learn from, frankly, and listen to earnings calls to like make sure that I'm kind of still in touch with what the big capital markets are looking for. But it's a very different skill set. And I don't think every fund can do this. Now, the funds you mentioned they're behemoths and able to manage a lot of things incredibly well. Plus, they often cater to very, very long-term investors. They cater towards endowments and pension funds specifically. These N, you know, N to the N type time horizons. And I, going back to the original question on deep tech, it is, I think these timelines, these kind of artificial timelines, are still constructive for the majority of funds. They still set an expectation, a general market expectation, that X timeline is the, you know, the time to either return or not. And then there are these select funds that are able to basically create their internal secondaries pool. They can pick the best and liquidate the others. The actual existence and growth of the others of like the real secondaries market, I think, is also a really important way to help create liquidity in this field. And it seems to have been like a big boost over the last couple of years, taking advantage of down market sentiment, GPs that needed to liquidate portfolios, companies that needed to, or investors that needed to liquidate companies, all those sorts of things. And I'm hoping that in the long run, that short boost of a window that has skyrocketed the secondaries market creates a really robust secondaries market that is not significantly discounting, but is appropriately discounting assets and allowing both VCs to cycle money in and out, which helps their LPs, which maybe have a different risk profile than secondaries investors, and then helps kind of recycle that into the same stage of investing.
Is it happening so often, secondary investments? Is it?
From what I understand, it's taken off. I mean, it's still nascent. I think it's still in the early stages for sure. But I mean, before 2020, it was something that you never even heard of. It was an exotic product. And now, you know, you meet secondaries investors. I hear a lot of people that have secondaries funds. And I think it's a clever thing to do for the market. I mean, there are a lot of opportunities. And right now, if you're a fund at year 12 and you have three assets left, you just have to keep begging your LPs to keep it on. And you know, if they're another 2x potential DPI waiting behind you, or you know, another 2x the fund's value, then of course they'll say for sure. But if it's a nominal part of the portfolio, maybe 10-20% of the portfolio, and still is taking the time of the managers, at those points it's probably more time effective to liquidate and find a secondaries opportunity. So I, in general, having that kind of liquidity of talent, liquidity of capital, and ability to shut down startup and shut down companies painlessly, I think is great for the ecosystem. And I do see pressure to make that happen, but it's not quite there yet.
I also think, I mean, this should be the core DNA of every entrepreneur. Find out quickly whether your idea works or not. If it works, double down and convince people to double down with you. And if it doesn't work, shut it down, destroy it, and go to the next thing and move on very quickly. I think this is mandatory. And the secondary investment thing, I mean, also when I started in the area in 2006, nobody did it. And it was also, yeah. I always got the answer, no, we don't do it. It doesn't happen. And in the last 2 years, it seems really to become a bigger and bigger movement on the market. I hear it more often. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. But let's focus the last part of the podcast on the future and how the future looks like. I love this part because I also mentioned already we should envision a bright future. How do you envision the venture landscape in 5 to 10 years? Where is it heading to?
Where do I see the venture landscape heading in 5 to 10 years? I see a lot of great new founding teams coming to the market, again, with this kind of mentality that we have to get to maybe not company profitability, but we've got to get to unit economic profitability or the business is not working. So what I expect to see is a much more mature set. And I don't mean like mature in terms of age. I think a more mature mindset, and a more grounded mindset of founders over this next cycle. And that's what we saw over the previous cycle. We saw some of the biggest companies founded in down markets. So I think that kind of resilience and fortitude towards unit economics and the focus at those early stages will create a really robust cycle this time around. In addition, Europe is a bit less cyclical than the US already. I mean, there's much more focus on B2B, and B2B is more stable. You get SaaS contracts, those are not rolling off. Like, people would rather pay their SaaS contracts than keep the lights on. And that can add to some of the stability, the robustness of the investing market. And so those are some of the things I'd expect to see. Now, some of the things I hope to see are an increased risk tolerance. Again, more of this kind of down to the basics, feet on the ground, mathematical approach. Are we doing what the models say we should be doing? Are we doing what our own models say we should be doing? Or are we just going, oh, I think we should probably invest this amount? And that's what I see a lot of investors doing, is using their own sentiment as gauge. And that is definitely not the way to do it. Like, in terms of investing in general, having a clear-headed approach to this investment opportunity, given the time horizon and all the information you can gather today, is critical. Instead of thinking about, am I riding this wave, or how do I feel about the rest of my portfolio, or am I underwater or overwater? Don't be too confident. Don't be too scared. Every investment opportunity has its own risks and its own return profile, and that needs to be measured in a calculated way at every single point in time differently.
Yeah, and meditate more often. Don't throw everything away, like I said.
I agree.
Let's come to the technological part of the future question. Which technologies will define the future? We had a digital wave in the last 10 to 20 years. How does the future look like? What are your picks in the promising technological landscape?
I'm very lucky to be in a fund where I think we can get a lot of shots on goal in exactly the areas that I think are taking off. We have an industrial focus on our fund, and in my previous investing, I'd largely been focused on software, and I pushed into a little bit of industrial tech, but on the software side. And I definitely think that we've not hit the limitations of software on everything, for sure. I mean, look at the AI explosion, but we'll see, you know, how much of it works and how much of it is just fantastic software that was going to be written anyway. But we will need more hardware, plain and simple, to be able to take the same astronomic leaps that in tech productivity that we've seen in the last couple of years. So if we want to keep that up, the risk profile will be different. I mean, I think getting back to one question you had earlier that I didn't really take advantage of at the time was the difference between huge exit hardware and small exit hardware. And I think there's a select group, or maybe even a big group, of companies that do have a venture profile, but will not be over the 500 million exit. And that still deserves venture financing if founders are willing to take the low valuations at day one, knowing that their exit windows are maybe limited. And so, going back to like some of the technologies specifically that I expect to take off in addition to general hardware, is automation. As we're seeing just more people, more of the workforce taper off, I think that's one of the areas that's required both on the software and hardware front. There's also, we need to find more energy sources. I mean, I like the German idea that of addiction, like this Energiesüchtig is one of, like, being addicted almost to energy. And when you see someone running around with a plug looking for, where do I get my next juice? Like, we are, as humans, we made ourselves energy addicted. And so we need to find more, better, cleaner, more sustainable energy resources. And as we talked about earlier, real sustainability. I'm not sure what that means. That's why I partner with people that are a lot smarter than me. But there's going to be more things on the market. And what that means is our risk tolerance as a society needs to be greater. We have bigger challenges to overcome than we perhaps ever have, which means that our willingness to make mistakes, make errors, burn capital, frankly, but hit those big successes at the same time along the way needs to be heightened and fine-tuned. And that's where I think we really need to get to is every fund needs to sincerely consider their place in the ecosystem. Where's their hotspot? Every fund has, by nature, by their size, by their LP base, by their GP's abilities, has their own risk return profile and their own ability to do X deals in, of X size into Y categories with Z amount of parameters. Find your place in the market, fine tune that spot, and then serve that part of the market with capital. And if you do it right, those funds that hit that sweet spot will be great returning funds. And not only will be able to fund amazing talent with very different profiles along the trajectory, but they'll also be great returners for their LPs, which will bring more capital into the ecosystem.
Yeah, focus usually helps. Focus usually helps creating great returns and staying focused also in tough times. Let's imagine that one of the other LPs listens to this episode and gets motivated to look more at the deep tech space. What's your 1 minute advice to them?
My 1 minute advice to, let's say, an LP that hasn't invested in VC yet. Take it slow, plan, commit, execute, and measure. Do all those in the same planned process that you have, and there are promising returns. It's a dangerous field to get into from day one, but if you take a distance approach at the beginning, but commit, there are great returns to be had, and the data points towards that. As I mentioned before, the median return of VC over at pretty much any time interval in Europe alone has been greater than most benchmark public equity funds in pretty much any category, whether it's small caps or large caps. So take that measured approach and explore the market and see whether your principles and your risk tolerance are willing to take it. But there's a huge opportunity out there.
Especially in Europe. It's an underserved market, so there's a lot of opportunity, a lot of talent. Oh, and at the end of our podcast recording, would you like to address a point that we didn't tackle yet? Would you like to send your message out into the internet?
You really highlighted my key message, which is adding to the capital formation in the deep tech sector and being able to work with great managers. The one last thing I'll end on, perhaps, is the reason I keep seeing so much hope in Europe is that there is this incredible technical expertise. But I would encourage founders, get out there, share your ideas, do not be afraid. There are brilliant people that I run across every day, and they're not always able to explain their ideas. So if people want to make an impact and have a big splash, go out and do something big. Do not think small. And I would encourage especially European founders to not think about what's in their lab, but take what's in their lab and see how big you can make this, how big you can grow this. What is the industry where you can have the largest impact? And that is, I think, that the type of sea change we need to see at the ground level. And we're starting to see. I mean, I get to work with founders that are thinking like this. They're taking an idea and making it massive. And I feel honored to be able to work with them. And I want to see more of that brilliance being brought to market, brought to industry, brought to applications, brought to use cases, and really explored. So get out there and do it. Feel free to touch base with me if anybody wants any of my ideas about how to do that.
Owen, thank you very much for these encouraging words. It's good to see your positive energy, your positive attitude and enthusiasm here in Europe. We need it. We need people like you.
Thanks so much, Christian. I really appreciate the time and certainly a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you very much for this great recording and have a great weekend. Bye.
Thanks so much.
And that concludes our insightful discussion with Owen Reynolds. Today, we have journeyed through the intricacies of venture capital, the undeniable impact of deep tech, and the vibrant future of the European venture scene. Thank you very much for joining this conversation. If Owen's words sparked a new idea, inspired a change, or simply resonated with you, please spread the word. Your support is invaluable. Liking, commenting, and sharing helps this podcast to grow and ensures that I can continue to bring you conversations with the minds shaping our technological future. It's your engagement that makes this possible. Remember, every share counts.
pass this episode along to someone in your network who could benefit from Owen's insights. Together, we can and will foster a community of innovation and growth. Stay tuned for more episodes that promise to enlighten, inspire, and motivate. Until next time, keep pushing boundaries and dreaming big.